Hello, welcome to this edition of the Bearcats Blogcast. Back after a brief hiatus, because somebody got sick last week. I'm joined by Chris Baines. How's it going today, Chris?
Hey, Scott. I'm not great. Not after what happened last Saturday, which we can definitely dive right into in a little bit. But, yeah, let's put a bow on this football season. We kind of wrapped up UC season a little bit. Didn't quite touch on the AAC as a whole. Final rankings for UCF, kind of the conference and coaching changes, the final rankings, etc. So yeah, we can just dive right into that. Starting with the biggest elephant in the room, Central Florida. I mean, they went 12-0. They had an excellent season. They are playing in, I want to say like the Citrus Bowl or something like that. They're playing Auburn, I think, right?
Peach Bowl,
close enough. Citrus, peach, similar fruits. They had a solid season. They couldn't climb higher than 10th, which, I mean, that's just a broader conversation that we just don't have time enough to cover. But, you know, they went undefeated. They're playing Auburn in the Peach Bowl as the Group of Five representative. Scott Frost is coaching that game, despite accepting the Nebraska gig. The East finished as Central Florida, South Florida, Temple, and then East Carolina, UC, and UConn all tied for last. Scott, thoughts on that finish? Scott's on Central Florida? Thoughts on anything, really?
I was pretty disappointed for Central Florida that they ended up just not breaking through at all.
Yep.
Like, they had some nice wins at the end of the season. Like, the game against South Florida was, like, pretty incredible. And then they followed it up with that game against Memphis. Just, like, another fun shootout. like, goes down to went to overtime. But, like, you kind of, like, just feel bad for that team that they didn't even get, like, a real look. Especially whenever the rankings came out the week before, and they were still like 14th behind Stanford, like who had lost three times. It's just like a tough break for them in that sense. I do think it's weird that Scott Frost is coaching the bowl game, because yeah, I don't think you ever see that, especially now that they have like the early signing period in the middle of December. You think you would, like, jump right into Nebraska instead of trying to juggle both the UCF job and the Nebraska job.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a really interesting thing going on there. I mean, how does that exactly work? So he's accepted the Nebraska job, so Nebraska's recruits know that he's going to be their next head coach. But you're right. I mean, the bowl game is on January 1st. I mean, obviously, it's the New Year's bowl game. And the early signing period is December 20th. So how does that work from a recruiting standpoint? Obviously, Nebraska is pretty much set. The current recruits know who their head coach is going to be. But, I mean, has Frost really put together a staff up in Nebraska to really, you know, go out and recruit during this dead period? Or not during the dead period, but during this period between bowls. And then as far as Central Florida's current staff, I mean, they hired Missouri's offensive coordinator, Josh Heupel, and Randy Shannon as the defensive coordinator. I don't know if they've hired any assistants. What is their direction now? I mean, are they basically 100% recruiting for Central Florida? are they focusing on Missouri's bowl game? Probably not. It's kind of a weird dynamic going on there with Scott Frost opting to coach Central Florida in the bowl game, which, I mean, props to him. I mean, that's excellent. I think that's great that he's staying with his players to see the season through. But just from an overall, you know, recruiting timeline standpoint, it's kind of odd.
Yeah, because you don't really see a coach like, oh, I'm going to recruit for this school and then still coach this other school, like follow through on this.
Right.
But I guess if he still had, I don't know, a week and a half or nearly 2 weeks between the signing periods to still coach UCF. But that does leave, like, Heupel in a weird position where I guess he's just recruiting, and then I don't co-coaching or whatever.
Right.
I don't know. That just seems weird. I know that coaches normally don't like just step in and start coaching until the season is over. So I guess he's just chilling or whatever. I don't know. I just think that's super kind of weird.
Yeah, and by the way, thanks for pronouncing his name. What I assume is correct. I was butchering it. Heupel. I'll make sure not to mispronounce it going forward. But yeah, it's December 8th, at least to the recording of this podcast. I don't know when Peach Bowl practices start, but I mean, you got to figure that, I mean, or you got to ask the question, how much of Scott Frost's time is devoted towards recruiting for Nebraska versus how much of this time is spent on Auburn game film? I don't really know. I mean, how... I think we're in a dead period as far as recruiting goes. It sounds like, I mean, I don't know if we are or not. I mean, even if we are, we could still start putting together, you know, a recruiting board for this, you know, 2018 class for Nebraska. It's kind of an odd situation as far as, you know, how much of his time is really devoted towards Nebraska versus how much of his time is devoted towards getting the team ready for the bowl. Because if we're not in a dead period, you got to figure most of his coaches are out on the recruiting trail trying to build that Cornhuskers 2018 recruiting class. Or maybe they're in the film room at UCF preparing for Auburn. I have no idea. It's just a really interesting situation.
It definitely is. Like, it had to be something he already worked out with Nebraska.
Right.
Because it does sound like, from like all the reports that came out during the game, which was just another terrible thing for UCF. It was like all the reports that he was gone to Nebraska came out during that game.
And Todd McShay, like not even the glimmer had come off of their AAC championship trophy, and he's already interviewing Scott Frost before he runs off the field about the Nebraska job. Like, great. It's classy Todd McShay.
But it did sound like he had like his whole coaching staff like already in place. So I guess it sounds like they were just ready to dive in. I guess he can balance both for now. I don't know. Like, yeah. They don't have a bowl game or anything to worry about, so there's not those extra practices they're getting.
Right.
But not, I don't know, it just seems weird. Like, it's cool that he's coaching their team. Like, he's following, like, through with, like, their best season, I guess, since the last time they went undefeated. But, yeah, I guess it's kind of cool. And it's like, they had a really great year. And it's like
it seems
like their future is kind of like bright, depending on like with like the way Missouri turned around. Like, you would think like their offense next year should be good, and for like all of Randy Shannon's like terribleness as a head coach, like he did a good job at Florida as their defensive coordinator, at least with a ton of talent. And if he can still like recruit and bring talent to UCF, they should be able to keep their machine rolling.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. And you got to figure, I mean, Heupel's there to basically run the offense at Central Florida. He's got a ton of talent that Frost is leaving him. And Shannon is there to break open doors in the Florida recruiting market, because I can't imagine Heupel has much contacts there. But that's probably one of Shannon's main gigs, is to basically help, you know, lead the recruiting efforts going forward. I mean, as far as, like, the end of the season goes, I think it's great. I mean, that they finished 10th, finally cracked the top 10 after however many goddamn weeks we've been clamoring about it. But, I mean, it's a good stamp on the AAC. I mean, they're going to play a very good Auburn team that, you know, they had a chance at the playoff, as it were, had they had beaten Georgia last Saturday. But, you know, they didn't. And, you know, maybe Central Florida goes out and beats them, and they end up somewhere in the top 10, higher in the top 10. Really, I mean, it's these kinds of seasons that, you know, really help solidify the AAC as separating itself from the rest of the G5. And I think Central Florida did that. Hopefully they can kind of put a stamp on it at the end of the season. What were your thoughts on South Florida's season? Because, I mean, they were picked to win the East. As we kind of went through the season, it seemed like Central Florida was the better team, which it turned out at the end of the day, just very, very closely, but it turned out at the end of the day that Central Florida was a better team. But what were your thoughts on South Florida's season? I mean, they finished 9-2, 6-2 in the AAC, a good season under Charlie Strong, but they were still picked to win the league.
Yeah, it was definitely a good season, but Like, there was something that was, like, just missing from it. Like, their
Yeah.
offense didn't really click the way that you thought it would. Like, just looking at what they did last season. And with, like, Quentin Flowers being back for his final year. Like,
Right.
he had some monster games. Like, the UCF game, especially. It's, like, a crazy game. But, like, only finishing 9-2. And, of course, not winning the league. Like, it's definitely something that stings for them. That. Because, like, when you looked at their preseason, like, the chances of them going undefeated were pretty high because their non-conference schedule was garbage.
Awful, right?
Even though, and, like, they lost a game from it, and, like, it was still terrible. And, like, the loss to Houston was, like, fluky, but it was just really a kind of, like, a head-scratching loss, like, even when you look back at it still. It's like, it was a good season, like, not a great one. And the fact that they were never ranked by the playoff committee, like,
Yep.
it just has to sting a little bit more.
I agree. I mean, I think it was a good, not great season. I think in a vacuum, a 9-win season is excellent. Like, I would have killed if UC had a 9-win season this year. But I think based on expectations, I think they saw some of the flaws of transitioning from like a Willie Taggart run team to a Charlie Strong run team. And that's not to say Charlie Strong had a bad year and is a bad coach. I think he's an excellent coach. But one of the things you saw with South Florida is that they had a drop off offensively this year. And Quentin Flowers, for all that he did shining under Willie Taggart, I mean, Willie Taggart, it seems like, Taggart brought the best out of Flowers. Whereas with Taggart leaving, you kind of saw him, he's a good quarterback, but he's not that overarching, dominant quarterback that he was under Taggart. So yeah, I think they had a good year, good, not great. I'm curious to see where the program goes in year two under Strong next season. They have a lot of good pieces, but I mean, are they going to win 9 games again? Or are they going to backslide? Or are they going to win more? I don't know. It'd be interesting to see how they kind of shift under Charlie Strong. Temple finished 6-6. They looked like shit at the beginning of the year, and seemed to finish strong. It seems like they're kind of on an uptrend going into 2018. I mean, what are your thoughts on their season?
I kind of agree with your point about them being on the uptrend for next season. Like, they got outscored for the season and in conference play, but although albeit by 9 points in conference play, so it's
Right.
not like it was they were terribly outscored. But like a really rough start where they had some really terrible losses, like all in a row. Then they finished the year by going 3-1, with wins over like Navy and Tulsa and Cincinnati. It's like they recovered nice to make a bowl, and like their defense seemed to get better as the year went on. But like you can't really look at like their season without just like noticing how bad their offense was at times.
Right.
It's like the game against UCF and the game against USF, both of those games, like on national TV, like they turn the ball over like 18 million times and get just gigantically blown out. Like they still have a lot of work to do on offense, and like finding a quarterback to like really carry them on next year, I think is pretty important, as well as like finding skill position players. Like overall, I think it was like a decent year, and they made a bowl game, so they get like one extra game. I guess I would give them like a mild thumbs up. What about you?
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate. Mild thumbs up. I mean, when you started the start of the season, I mean they got blown out by Notre Dame, and their only wins were over FCS Villanova 16-13 and FCS UMass 29-21. So I mean, not really impressive wins. And then they wound up getting blown out by South Florida, losing to Houston. But that coach, that quarterback change going to Frank Neutile, I mean, that was key. I mean, he really lifted that offense. And he's a junior. He's gonna go into his final season at Temple next year, presumably the starter. And they could challenge for the East. I mean, who knows what's gonna happen at Central Florida and South Florida? Who knows if the coaching change at Central Florida is really gonna knock them back down off their high horse, or if that's gonna keep them riding high. With the new coaching staff. I mean, Temple always plays good defense. Who knows if that's really going to carry them into next season with a hopefully, revamped offense under the new quarterback. I got to figure, I mean, if you're looking at the bottom three teams, East Carolina, Cincinnati, and UConn, I mean, those three are still probably a year away. UC, hopefully less than that. But you got to figure the top half of the division, Central Florida, South Florida, and Temple, are pretty much going to be just fighting amongst themselves for the divisional crown.
Yeah, that does make Temple a bit of a wild card. Because all it really takes for them to like move up, like to challenge in contention, is just beating one of those teams, and it seems like they have like a pretty decent shot at it. Especially if like Newtile like continues to develop. It's like you said, they were like a different team once he took over, and like he had some really solid games, especially against like the worst defenses, really. Let's just say that part. Like he beat, he did like carve up Navy and Cincinnati and Tulsa. And like while he didn't have a good game against UCF, like their other losses were close. Like they lost to Army in overtime. Like the UConn game was like a really close. Houston was one score. It's like if like they turn any of those games around, like maybe their year is like completely different. But
yeah, and that's the thing is like that quarterback change. I mean, it basically just gave them a little bit more offensively, you know. And you're right, like the UConn game, the Army game, they were close. I mean, you have a few balls go your way, and Temple's all of a sudden an above 500 team. And I mean, who knows what's going to happen next year with them? Going on to the West, Memphis won the West, lost in the conference championship game. One of the more exciting conference championship games of last weekend. I think it actually rivaled, as far as like rating standpoint, I think it rivaled the Big 12. No, it wasn't the Big 12 or the ACC. One of the two, as far as viewership is concerned. I mean, Central Florida beat Memphis in a shootout, but I mean, Memphis had arguably one of the best offenses in the country. They scored the most points in the AAC. It's just their defense couldn't stop anybody. So they lost a couple of games. They won the West. Houston finished second. Navy finished third. I can't remember the preseason rankings. I feel like it was Navy picked to finish to win the league or win that division. Memphis was, I think, second or third. It was either like 1, 2, or 3. It was like Memphis, Houston, Navy. What was your thoughts on the West?
Well, Memphis like definitely stood out. They lost to one team like all last season, and it was like Central Florida. Like it did take, like they had the big win over UCLA, like to really kickstart their season when UCLA was in the top 25. And then like they went to UCF and just got like steamrolled, and it seemed like that took some of the luster off of Memphis. But then like they just rolled back and like beat Navy when Navy was in the top 25, like won at Houston, and then like once they beat Houston, like the rest of the division like didn't stand a chance, and they hung 56, 41, 66, 70. Like their offense is just incredible. And with like Mike Norvell sticking around, like that's like definitely a good sign for them. And you would think they'd be right back on the top of the division next year, even with like Houston probably still having a good recruiting class and definitely having Ed Oliver, who just won the Outland Award as the top interior lineman. Like, so like you got to think those teams are going to be right back on top, like fighting for the division title. And I give like the slight edge to Memphis. If, I don't know, just because I kind of think they're a little bit better. Houston did take a bit of a step back last season.
Right.
Mainly because they couldn't find a quarterback. But Memphis is going to lose Riley Ferguson, so like maybe Houston can step in. But what do you think? What do you think about who should be slated to come out of the West next year? Or is it Navy? Are we sleeping on Navy too much?
Navy concerns the hell out of me. I mean, look at their season. They started 5-0, and they lost 6 of the last 7. I'm sorry, 5 of their last 6, and they've got Army tomorrow. I think they were picked to win the West. justifiably so. I mean, they're Navy. I mean, we talk about this all season. I feel like you're almost always guaranteed Navy's going to have a solid year at minimum, and they are. I mean, they're 6-5. But man, the last couple of months, I mean, they lost to Memphis 30-27, Central Florida 31-21, Temple 34-26. They beat SMU barely. They lost to Notre Dame 24-17, lost to Houston 24-14. So like they lost 5 of those 6 games by a possession. So if we're going to use kind of the Temple logic, I mean, if the ball bounces their way, they're better than 6-5. But at the same time, I mean, Houston and Memphis are returning their head coaches. They're probably going to have solid recruiting classes. You're right. Riley Ferguson is gone for Memphis going into next year. But you got to figure Mike Norvell has them cooking, so they're probably at a minimum an 8-win team. I think it's almost kind of a similar situation as the East. Like going into next year, Memphis, Houston, Navy, you could pretty much pick any of those three to win the West. I would probably lean more towards Memphis or Navy. And you'd probably be right. If Chad Morris didn't leave for Arkansas, I probably would have thrown SMU into the mix, but it's SMU. That's going to be a tough gig for whoever's coming in there.
Yeah, it's going to be really tough for them, especially when you lose like your like best player in Cortland Sutton. Like, if Morris did stick around, I would have them in the mix, too, because they had a pretty solid season, like, at 7-5, like, 4-4 in the league. They actually won road games. But it seemed like they are on the right trajectory. If they make a good coaching hire, which it sounds like they're looking for the next Chad Morris, is what people are saying. Like, if they hit a home run hire and they can, like, recruit well in Texas... It's just like the Florida schools. Like if you do well, like recruiting, like in that big state, like you can still be solid. And so it just took a couple of classes for them to turn around from the disaster that was the end of the June Jones era. But like they did it and they made it through. And like their defense still needs some work. And like they lose Morris and they lose like their offensive coordinator. So they're gonna have some struggles, but. Like, that does seem like a pretty decent job. And if you can just have a good offense, it seems like you can do a lot in this league. So you got to think they'd be looking for some big, like, offensive coach.
Yeah, you would hope. I mean, Chad Morris, I mean, he's never known for his defense. I mean, SMU's always outscored teams to win games. I mean, that obviously outscored a team to win a game. But they basically relied on the offense to win games. I mean, even in their losses, I mean, the loss to Memphis, 66-45. Navy, again, we talked about the 43-40. Central Florida, 31-24. I mean, SMU had the offense to compete with anyone in the league. It's just the defense was terrible. I mean, they couldn't stop anybody. And if you're SMU and you're relying on Chad Morris' speed recruits on offense, I mean, I agree. I think they probably have to go after some offensive coordinator somewhere to kind of keep that rolling. Because I feel like if you go back and go hire a defensive-minded coach, who maybe he brings in an offensive coordinator to kind of keep that going, but miss on the offensive coordinator side, then you risk sliding the next couple of years trying to rebuild on the going from an offensive-minded team to a defensive-minded team. I mean, that's a risk you run there. So I agree. I think SMU goes with the offensive-minded coach. Rounding out the West, if we even really want to talk about them, Tulane and Tulsa. I don't even really want to talk about Tulsa. I think that's kind of a pit of shame over there. Tulane, though, is an interesting, I don't know, case study, I would say. They started off hot. They looked to be turned around completely. And they ended up backsliding and finishing 5-7.
Well, they got absolutely screwed over at the end of that SMU game. Like, I know it's like we should like go back and talk about stuff that late. But, like, they run a questionable quarterback run at the end of the game with, like, 8 seconds left.
Yeah.
The quarterback clearly gets in the end zone. They call him out. He call him out. And review clearly shows him, like, getting in. And then, no, it stands. And they lose to SMU. It finished 5-7. Like,
and let's not even talk about the UC game where they missed a field goal at the end to lose there. So yeah, I mean they're arguably a 7-5 team if just like literally two plays go their way. Go ahead.
Yeah, and they gave like Navy a real run for their money early in the season too, like in a tough game at Navy. If like they had any type of special teams, they could have maybe had 8 wins.
Right.
And, like their special teams was trash, and they blew a couple of really, really bad games. At least for them. Like, they're an interesting team going forward because, obviously, like, Willie Fritz can coach.
Yep.
And he's coming back, and his teams, like, seem to always make a jump. So, I think, like, the future for them is kind of bright. And I believe that UC does play them next year, so it'll be something to watch. Like,
Are they a dark horse in the West?
I kind of think they could be a dark horse in the West. It's... Because we really don't know what Memphis is going to be like without Riley Ferguson. And so, like, maybe there's, like, a bit of a void where Tulane can, like, jump in there and win a couple of games. Because they do have their quarterback coming back, which is always, like, pretty big, especially in this league, where, like, so much of, like, the rising tides are just based on continuity.
Yep.
Like, it's like, who knows, like, how Tom Herman would have done if they didn't have Greg Ward as his quarterback for his whole run. Like, just that, like, really helped blossom their entire offense. And, like, Riley Ferguson, like, a big quarterback, a big-name quarterback, and he helped Mike Norvell, like, transition right in. And we didn't really know what Mackenzie Milton was, but, like, his blossoming into, like, the AAC Player of the Year and one of the better quarterbacks in the nation, like, really... help Scott Frost get that Nebraska job.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, Tulane, they had a good year, not great, and Willie Fritz can clearly coach. I mean, if he had left for another gig after this season, gotta say Tulane slides back to Tulsa or hell, East Carolina territory. But, I feel like if Tulane, because they run that option offense, I mean, they're so tricky to defend against. If they come back roaring out of the gates, they pull an upset on Navy, they can keep game close against Memphis and Houston, and maybe let's have some of those games go their way. I mean, they could definitely win the West. To your point, the uncertainty at the top, uncertainty at Houston and Memphis and to an extent Navy.
It's just going to take some big efforts to beat those teams. It's like Tulane gets Memphis at home next year. They go to Houston. They host SMU. It's like, there's a chance they could do something. They host Navy. It's like the ball seems to be in their court for some upsets. But, like, in the league, like, just during conference play, there's only 5 teams that had positive scoring ratios, meaning they outscored their opponents, and Tulane was one of them. Which seems like a gigantic upset. But it says a lot for how, like, they were able to rally around in conference play and, like, pick up some nice wins.
Right.
And not get blown out, which was, besides the Memphis game, which, like, every other team in the conference did. It helped they didn't play either Central Florida.
Right. And even then, you got to figure, I mean, they probably keep that one relatively close. It's probably, you know, within a couple of touchdowns. You know, not like the UC level of blowouts we've experienced against Central Florida and South Florida this year. I mean, overall thoughts on the conference? I mean, the AAC's definitely proven that they've got a leg above the rest of the G5. I guess for me, going forward, it's got to be consistency. I know you, Matt, and I talked about it earlier in the season. Just by way of how the G5 gets the Access Bowl now, I feel like it's more important to have like an undefeated Central Florida than have, you know, a couple of 9-2 or 9-3 teams at the top where you risk having like a San Diego State or Boise State slip in there out of the Mountain West. I mean, what are your thoughts on kind of like the state of the conference and kind of like going forward with the AAC as far as this relation to the G5?
It's like the hardest thing with the league is just somebody staying on top, because any success, like, you lose your coach. Like, it doesn't matter if you have, like, amazing success like UCF or just, like solid, like, an uptick like you, like SMU. Like, nobody would be like, oh, SMU was the best team in the league. But they're clearly on the rise, and, like, Chad Morris was doing a good job, and now he's gone, and they have to, like, not stumble on their next coaching hire. Like, it seems like the biggest hurdle in front of all of these teams. Like, that's why, like, just, like, being able to find people who can pick up the ball and, like, keep it going is so huge. Because, like, it's like a team from this league or any other, like, G5 league is never going to get any serious consideration for the playoff. Like, we learned that this year. I doubt there's going to be too many teams that are as good as UCF in the future. Like, they had, like, nearly outscored their opponents by 300 points. It's, like, insane.
Yeah.
Like, the scoring margin was, like, just crazy. And, like, they just got, like, no respect. But, like, the league as a whole was, like, really fun to watch. Like, all these, like, interesting offensive minds. And then, like, you have, like, somebody like Charlie Strong. And I guess, like, Fickell would count as a defensive mind. Since, like, UC's offense was trash. like, you have, like, some interesting things, like, trying to counter, like, what's going on where. And, like, obviously, you have, like, Memphis and Houston and, like, those two big schools in the West who are just going to probably seem to reload every year. And I think it's interesting to see what happens at Memphis if they can keep this up, because they've been really consistent in the conference and really strong. I don't think a lot of people really saw that coming from Memphis.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest advantages, it's almost like an advantage and a disadvantage, is that, you know, success to your point, any successful team is ripe to have their head coach snatched away by a Power 5 team. I mean, we've seen that, you know, Justin Fuente left Memphis, Scott Frost left Central Florida, Willie Taggart left South Florida, so on and so forth. The good news is that being in the AAC, you've established yourself with the reputation of, A, if you are good in this conference, you will pretty much be able to handpick even top Power 5 jobs. Like, Central Florida, you know, if you're in, like, the Mountain West and you have some success, you will probably get picked to either go to, like, some Power 5. I mean, you have to have, like, a lot of success. Like Chris Peterson types of success out of Boise State. Like, you know, he anchored himself in Boise State for a while before Washington plucked him away. But, you know, Scott Frost was only in Central Florida for 2 years, and now he's going to Nebraska, a potential top Big Ten team with a hell of a lot of history, a ton of resources, you know, getting thrown at him. That's not going to happen in a MAC or a Sun Belt or anything like that. And then B, I mean, from a facilities and financial standpoint, I mean, the American holds itself over every other conference. I mean, you look at the salaries in this conference. I mean, $3 million head coaches. I don't see a Conference USA or Sun Belt or Mountain West team consistently paying that amount, as well as you have all the facilities to back it up. So, yeah, I think going forward is definitely concerning that you're running into a situation where coaches will leave pretty quickly if they see the amount of success that even like a Chad Morris saw it at SMU. But on the back end, you're able to backfill those coaches with, or you're able to attract higher tier coaches pretty easily in this conference over like a G5. And I feel like even like if you're talking about the Power 5 like ranks, I mean, hell, even Willie Taggart left Oregon for Florida State this week. you know, Oregon a few years ago was seen as a destination job. It just kind of goes to show that like there's no such thing as like a destination job outside of like a few schools. Like every school can be seen as a stepping stone. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it's like you do see so much movement like Dan Mullen. Obviously, like him going to Florida, like, not a surprise to anybody. But he still left, like, a SEC job for another SEC job. So, like, that stuff does happen. Like in this league, yeah, you're right. Like there's like a lot of interesting hires, which I don't really think anybody saw coming from the league because it didn't really happen so much in the Big East. But like, now it's been like the AAC. We've seen like a lot of like teams trying different things, like and like having like different like levels of success. Like obviously, like every coach that's won the league, except for like what George O'Leary, like he just like resigned or retired. But like everybody else, like went on to bigger and better things. Like you mentioned Taggart. Well, they didn't win the league, but Matt Rhule, they won the league last year, and he ended up leaving. And, like, so on and so forth. Now I can't remember. Like, Houston won the league, and Tom Herman, like,
right.
Texas.
And that's a great selling point for the conference, is that look at the guys who have gotten the top, like, the biggest buzz around in the coaching carousel the last few years, and where have they come from? Tom Herman, Justin Fuente, Matt Rhule. They all had excellent success in the AAC. Then this year, Scott Frost had excellent success and he's going to Nebraska. Next year, Mike Norvell, if he has excellent success, he can handpick a Power 5 job. Charlie Strong, the same thing.
Dan, you mentioned Justin Fuente.
Yeah, and yeah, it's the AAC's established themselves as a reputation of, you have success here with all of these resources, you can handpick your Power 5 job down the road. Bring us a couple championships along the way, and you know, we'll call it even. But that's one of the things that the AAC definitely holds itself above the rest of the G5. You know, for better or worse, you're going to lose that coach in a couple of years. Maybe you hold on to him for 3 or 4, but like we were talking about, I mean, at least they bring success and attention and hopefully some hardware to your program.
It just seems like it, like especially with like the name of your programs, like your like UCFs or like South Florida, even like Cincinnati. If like Cincinnati goes 8-4 this season, like Luke Fickell is going to definitely be in coaching rumors. Just because like that's what happens. Like if you can win at this level, that's a pretty good indicator that you can like win and recruit at the higher levels.
Yeah, exactly. Like I can't imagine like. Real quick, just someone coming out of the AAC and like failing outright at a higher tier gig. Go ahead.
That really hasn't happened so far. Like, we can't like just say, "Oh, Matt Rhule failed," because that situation was really toxic.
Oh yeah, I mean, like people are saying that about James Franklin when he took over the Penn State job, but he's doing fine.
Yeah, that seems to have worked out well for them now.
Right.
Yeah, it's like a good trial grounds where like a lot of interesting things happen. Like this league is like a lot more fun to watch than it was a couple of years ago, just because like there's been obviously like a lot of talent, and like the two best players like in the league, like Milton and Ed Oliver, are both sophomores, or at least were both sophomores. Like you have like a ton of like your at least like your couple of your big marquee players coming back. It's like it's gonna give the league some things to like hang their hat on.
Yep.
And they, like even if like you've like tried like fail spectacularly, like these teams, at least some of them are like willing to just fire their coach and try something different really quick. And it works in some cases. Like it worked at Houston, where like they're God, get out of here, Tony Levine. Like if we're winning 7 games or whatever he did. But in like an East Carolina's case, it failed miserably when they fired Ruffin McNeil, and like, they're still trying to like, get something going. And like Cincinnati, I guess you could say they're trying to get something going too after a massive mishire in Tommy Tuberville.
Right. Yeah, so I think the overall health of the league is fine. I mean, the challenge obviously going forward is just building your respect in relation to the Power Five, but I mean, that's a conversation for a different day. That's something we're not going to solve in one podcast. So
yeah, that one's going to take some work.
Right. Any other thoughts on football before we jump over to hoops?
No, but we should shout out James Smith for first team all league. The only Bearcat to get first team honors. Like he was a really good punter, especially for a freshman, and like yeah, he did a great job, and it's good to see like him get a nod of approval from the coaches.
Yeah, and what's interesting, I mean, looking at the Ray Guy Award finalist and winner this year was an Australian punter. And obviously, you know, UC has their own, and he won, you know, he got first team All-AAC, and very deservedly so. But it's great that, you know, the trend in college football is to go to more of the rugby style punting, and in order to do that, you know, teams are grabbing guys out of Australia. UC got their own in James Smith, and it's already, you know, bearing fruit. So yeah, great for James Smith. Good thing going forward. Definitely one of the few bright spots on the team this year.
Yeah, and the team gave him a lot of chances to get good at punting, and he took advantage that's right. of them.
He was definitely able to pad those stats. That's for sure.
We should mention Corey Cunningham, second team, and so was Jalen Minor. And Marquise Copeland, honorable mention. It's like, that was it for the Bearcats. But good. Solid job for those four players. Yeah, let's move on to basketball. We could have led with basketball, but I'm pretty sure everybody's tired of talking the shootout. That's why we went with football first. With all the crazy stuff that happened at the end of that game, we need to take a cool down. And
yeah, we'll be brief on the shootout. Let's just say that.
Like obviously, we have to talk about what the press conference stuff, just because that's like way too important not to talk about. But like, what was your, like, just what's your biggest takeaway from that? Like now that we've made it through like a week of that being like the only thing people are talking about from the shootout.
I mean, so I hate talking about that because it's like the game inside the game. It's all just the silliness that goes on out around the shootout that I just hate. JP and Mick going after each other. That's part of that's just the atmosphere of the shootout. Part of that is JP McCura being immature. And then Mick, I feel like, comes out of that looking... He doesn't look good. I feel like he's almost basically... It's like he's taking out his frustrations on getting blown out to X again at the CentOS Center on JP McCura. Now, obviously, JP antagonized him, and he had a lot of what Mick said coming, but you don't look like the better guy coming out of that. Maybe in a few days, you know, the stuff settles from the shootout, and then Mick comes back, you know, on, you know, Wednesday or a Thursday after the shootout and says, yeah, you know, I thought JP acted immaturely, but, you know, I still shook his hand after the game. And then Chris Mack's comments, you know, trying to reference Lance Stevenson, calling him the N-word a few times back when in the shootout when he was here, just also seems petty. I mean, why are you, you know, basically he's essentially justifying JP's comments by saying, hey, yeah, a Bearcat did that to me 9 years ago, and, you know, I just shook it off, so I'm a better man, and JP is just being the kind of player that UC, you know, recruits and stuff like that. So it just was an ugly situation. I didn't like any of it all the way around, and it just made the entire day worse. What were your thoughts, Scott?
Yeah, it just like it devolved into like a bunch of pettiness and like just focus off the game.
Right.
But
which, I mean, I guess if you're a UC fan, I mean, that's better.
Yeah, that's a good thing for like how the game went. Like in like the grander scheme, it's just something more that just really is gonna fuel the rivalry for next year. Just another talking point, even though like JP McCure is gonna be gone. But yeah, it's like all the players like on Xavier where like, this would happen. Like it's the least surprising with him. Obviously, everybody has seen everything he's done like in his entire career. Like, yeah. Even, like, their game against Wisconsin earlier this season, like, he made waves for, like, taunting the student section as that game was wrapping up. Like, he's never been known for not being, like, I don't want to say, like, a douchebag. But, like, that's what, like, he kind of is. that's definitely, like, what he is, like, on the court. And
yeah.
And I guess it works for him since he's like on the top 25 team.
Well, that's the thing is, like, you know, Mick has to go into that situation knowing that this is a guy you don't want to fuel the him antagonizing you. You don't want to feed into that. You have to be the better man. I mean, that doesn't justify what JP did. JP was being an asshole to Mick and running his mouth, but Mick, that can't be the first time a player's spoken to him like that, either on his team or an opponent, or even the fans. Like, I mean, how many times does Mick get made fun of for being short or bald or whatever in the CentOS Center and opposing arenas? I mean, he has to have thicker skin and not cost his team, you know, opportunities because of that. Again, I don't think either Xavier or Cincinnati look good in that situation, but I don't know. Mick handled himself so well after the crosstown punch out. I'm surprised that he let it all get to him today, or, you know, last Saturday.
Yeah, I am too. Like nationally, it didn't seem like that big a surprise because that's like Mick Cronin, and he gets really upset about weird things sometimes.
Right.
But then you would like to see him like not get into it with an opposing player. As you mentioned, like, J.P. Mercura, not the first player in the history of college basketball to talk shit. Definitely not the last. And probably definitely not the last to try to provoke Mick Cronin like that. Especially right. If it works. And, like, he gets a tech during the middle of the game. So, yeah, it's, like, something to, like, keep an eye on. Because, I mean, if you were a player on another team, like, wouldn't you try to bait Mick Cronin or do something like that? Like, I probably would. It's like, what's it matter? He's the coach on the other team. He's not going to do anything to J.P. Mercura. Like, what does J.P. Mercura care what Mick Cronin thinks about him?
Right. I mean, the worst case scenario, maybe you get a technical foul. But I mean, if Mick's prone to react like that, I mean, it would either negate because he would get a technical foul himself, or just Mick would get called. And it's, I don't know. It was an awful game, an awful day. I did not like the way that Mick handled it afterwards. To your point, it comes off as petty, and I don't know. It just leaves a bad taste in my mouth. I mean, the crosstown shootout is always a tough pill to swallow, especially if UC loses and recently in the CentOS Center get blown out. But I mean, you add on all of that on top of it, and it just makes UC look bad.
Next, I don't think either school like looks particularly great coming out of it, and like, which is kind of disappointing for like the game.
Yeah,
even though like the game itself not very good, but I guess we can like transition and talk about that and put the other stuff aside. Unless you have something else you want to bring up about it.
No, we got plenty to talk about from the game itself.
Yeah, 89 points like UC gave up. The surprise, I think that was the headline from this game, like the actual game, is like UC's defense, like absolutely shredded. Xavier scores 1.19 points per possession, shoots like 47% from the field, 10 of 21 from three, 30 free throws. Like the defense, like has been like pretty good all season, like still ranks top 10 on KenPom, but like their first real competition, and just to get like punched in the mouth like they did against Xavier. Like, obviously a tough place to play. Like, they never win there. But, like, the defense, I thought, was just a bit of a concern. Like, after playing a bunch of cupcakes and getting, like, a real road game and just getting hammered.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that That 89 points was like some kind of record for points allowed in the Mick Cronin era, either like non-conference or road game or something like that. It was some kind of record. Xavier shot lights. I mean, no matter the game at the CentOS Center, Xavier always shoots lights out. I mean, they jumped out to a huge lead. They shot, damn, 64% from three in the first half. They shot 57% from the field. They were getting shredded in two areas, which is very concerning. Down low, Kyle Washington got worked. He's always played.
He got worked, and then he didn't play the second half.
Yes, that too, which is justified. He's always been more of a finesse power forward. You know, he's got the outside shot. He's got the ability to kind of get nice touch around the rim. But Xavier knew that and went right after him. He folded. He collapsed like a deck of cards, and he didn't play well, you know, at all that game. I mean, this seems like his defensive performance caused him to have an awful game overall. And then the 3-point shooting. Perimeter defense. Jacob Evans awful defensively. Their rotation and shifting was terrible. Xavier, even though they shot lights out from three, they were given a lot of open looks. I mean, it wasn't like an open gym kind of situation, but UC was giving them a ton of open looks. So, I mean, it figures that they shot 64% in the first half and then 47% overall. I mean, I don't know.
That just opened
I don't
up.
Know. You,
Coleman looks to the best player on the court. Like,
yeah, that too. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
It's like Trayvon Blewett should not be the Xavier player getting like a ton of open looks. And it was Trayvon Blewett getting a ton of looks. Like some of that's because the X offense did a good job exploiting UC's defense. But, like, man, like, if you can like stop one player on their team, it's got to be Blewett. And like 2 years in a row, they did not stop Trayvon Blewett. Like, that UC did win last year, but... Like, man, like, he's going to leave Xavier, like, having left his mark on the shootout, like, for sure. And you can, like, even tuck in, like, the perimeter offense, which was Jacob Evans and Gary Clark being the only guys who hit anything from three, and they went 5-for-14.
Right.
The rest of the team goes 3-for-14.
Right. Yeah, and that's how I'd say, like, Evans and Cumberland were great offensively. It was just defensively, they were just nowhere. Like, they were not doing anything on the perimeter to challenge Xavier, and especially Blewett. And that's the biggest concern to me. I mean, I think we kind of thought going into the season, yeah, UC had the offense to keep up with most teams this year, but they can't just go flatline on defense. I mean, that's not the style this team plays in.
Yeah, like, one of the things, like, McCronin talked about after the game was, like, how, like, the... If they missed shots or something, it translated back on defense, and it definitely did.
And yep.
That's like a mark of like that team like not being able to do whatever it wanted on offense for the first time this season. It's like a lot of it's not to pick on Washington, but gets off to a slow start like offensively, and then like nothing defensively. Like you said, Xavier went like right at them every single time. Like Tyreek Jones, I think he scored all 8 of his points at the beginning of the game, and Cantor had like a monster game, like kind of out of nowhere. That's like, yeah, like the interior defense, like so bad. Like they, Mick Cronin just like rotates like a bunch of different guys into the center spot. Like we saw a lot of Trey Scott, who like played pretty decent. We saw like a lot of Sosa May, which is kind of interesting. Like he had a big defense.
Very surprising. Yeah, I don't think Mick expected to play Sosa May that game.
I don't either. Like his defense, like was. Really good, like 4 blocks, 3 rebounds, a steal. But, like, playing Sosabe, like, you're playing 4-on-5. And, like, with some of the lineups they were playing, like, just out of necessity to try to get stops, like, weren't really conducive for a comeback. And, like, UC had some chances to, like, cut it to single digits. And they never did. Like, their offense just, I don't know, like, it got into some weird spurts. Where they try to score like 10-point baskets, when you just have to chip away at big leads, you can't like get it all back at once.
Right. I mean, to their credit, near the end of the first half, they were doing that, but the problem was is that they were, you know, for every stop they would have, they would either turn it over or miss a shot, you know, offensively. So, and not just like threes, but like stuff around the rim. I mean, I think their overall game plan offensively was fine. It's just that the defense was just so outright terrible that the offense had not could just not keep up. I was really disappointed. I mean, the fact that Kyle Washington just was completely a ghost in that game was disappointing. But then the problem I have is that Sosa May Scott and Brooks, I mean, Brooks especially didn't really do much. He looked soft again. Scott was okay. Sosa May, I thought Sosa May actually played pretty well for the minutes he played. I mean, as good as any of the other power forwards out there not named Gary Clark. And going forward, is this a concern? Like, if Kyle Washington has as bad of a game against Xavier as he will against, you know, Florida upcoming tomorrow night, are they basically going to be playing 4 and 5 again? That's my concern going forward.
I think that's a legit concern. And I do think, like, Washington's performance, like, we don't want to go too crazy because it was one game. But, like, he did only play 13 minutes the game before, which it was against Alabama State. But, but whatever. It does, like, enter the thing where last season, like, his minutes work, he pretty much played, like, half the game. It got cut down that much. If you just, like, look at his box scores, like, a lot of, like, 20, 15 minutes, like, performances in that range. And I think he's too vital to the team this season to take that big of a backseat. Like, now he's, like, one of your senior leaders.
Yeah.
And, the big men, the young big man, like, off the bench, like, they're intriguing, but there's no offense. Like, you're not going to get really much from Trey Scott or Nysir Brooks, who barely played against Xavier, or Sosa May at this point in his career. Like, it's really important that you get, like, Kyle Washington involved, especially on the defensive end. Go ahead.
And that's the thing, is, like, if you look at, like, Jacob Evans, he had a horrible game defensively. But he made up for that by going 9-15 from the field and scoring 23 points. And then Jerron Cumberland, he had a bad game defensively, but he was 5-12 from the field and finished with 15 points. But then if you look at Kyle Washington, he had a poor game defensively and just completely collapsed and didn't contribute at all the rest of the game. His best stat was a block. Like, that's awful. Awful, awful, awful. Not what you want from a senior leader.
Yeah, and like his, like, 1 minute he played the second half, he came in and got, like, a frustration foul and was right back on the bench. I think he played, like, one possession the second half.
Right. And I think that's concerning because it's like, this is not the first time that Mick has had to bench Kyle this year, right? Like, even during the stretch in the Caymans, I think he got benched a couple of times. I think he didn't start a couple of games. I think Mick started either Trey Scott or Nysir Brooks a couple of those games in place of Washington. I'd have to go back and check.
He did.
But I mean, that's the thing, is like, UC's played two seasons this year. They played everything up until the Xavier game where they just basically out-talented and outplayed far lesser opponents. And then they played the Xavier game. It's hard to take any conclusions from both of those, but one of the concerning consistent things we've seen is that Kyle Washington is alarmingly inconsistent game to game, and Mick is getting frustrated with him. And I think that's what's kind of concerning going into this very difficult stretch against Florida, Mississippi State, and UCLA.
Because you just need Kyle Washington to be a player on this team. Like, if they're going to hit the heights that they're capable of, that has to be, like, 1 through 5 in their starting lineup. And, like, the guys off the bench, like they rely so much on their starters.
Right.
Like, Kyle Washington has to come through. Like, he can't have, like, a yo-yo year like he, like, pretty much did last year. Like, oh, here's a big game. And then, oh, now we're playing somebody really good. And, like, he could either score, like, 12 or he's going to score, like, 3. Like,
right.
There was just no in-between, no consistency from Washington. And, like, it seems like they're still searching for that because, like, he does bring a lot to the table offensively. But, like you said, like, it defensively is, like, really where, like, they need it from him. And, like, playing a team like Florida, like, who we know has a ton of talent, they're not playing like it right now. But, like, they're a really good team. And, like, if he shows up and, like, has another, like, game where he just gets bullied around, I think it's a bit of a concern for, like, the rest of the season. Because he's just going to get targeted by everybody in league play. Like, SMU is going to target him, and Wichita State especially. Like, They really pick out matchups and go after them.
Yeah, I mean, the good news is that Florida, I mean, Florida's biggest strength is not their forwards, it's their guards. I mean, they shoot almost 40% from three. It's freaking, that scares me as well, but this could hopefully be a game where Kyle Washington rebounds after the Xavier game. I mean, he doesn't need to be the tower down low that uses his body to basically carve out an area 3x3 down there and like declares that no one's going to get through him like Ante Gates used to do. He just needs to be a guy who can grab rebounds and can score 10 points or something offensively. You know, get into double digits offensively and grab rebounds. I mean, that's his game. I mean, he doesn't need to be the dominant presence down low. He just needs to grab rebounds and get points, and that's all we're asking of him. If he gives up some of that defensively, fine. But as long as he's going to put up those two numbers, that's great. I mean, hopefully we see this Saturday. But, man, if he has another game where he just ghosts for 40 minutes or 14, however much he played against Xavier, it's going to be a rough. It's going to be another rough game.
Yeah, it is. Because, yeah, like, for all the good we've seen with this UC team, like the Xavier game does give you like a pause to like jump all in and be like, oh, this is like a top 10 team, like capable of like amazing things. Like they still are, but
right,
it does like make you pump the brakes a little bit. Like now that they played somebody good and like that was the result. Like I think that's a really interesting game. Just like from where Florida is, like having like a. Just like completely, like the wheels seemed like they came off for them this week. Like losing, getting blown out by Florida State, losing to Loyola Chicago at home. Like they need a pretty big statement non-conference win, and so does Cincinnati. Like, so
I mean, the good news is that the good news or bad news, however you want to look at it. Either the good news is Florida is bad, and this is who they are, and they're not a Final Four team like we thought 2 weeks ago, or you know, and hopefully they continue to slide into tomorrow, you know, through like 8 or 9 p.m. however long this game lasts. Or on the opposite side, they actually are a Final Four team, and they happen to just you know lose by three to Duke. Florida State is actually an undefeated team, and they're playing like an undefeated team, and that's who they are. Loyola Chicago is a 9-win team this season. Potentially a Missouri Valley favorite. Maybe they just played really bad teams and Florida is very good. I'm sorry, maybe they just played really good teams and Florida is as advertised and they're just in a rough patch. And unfortunately for the Bearcats, my concern is that they come back and they, you know, quote unquote, find it again tomorrow night. That's my concern. Because Florida is a good team. I don't know if they're Final Four worthy, but I still think they're a good team, and they just had a rough patch.
Yeah, they definitely had a rough patch. Like, their three-point shooting, like especially for home games, like, was terrible. 6-25 against Florida State, followed by 2-19 against Loyola. Like, you expect better from, like, their players. Like, you said earlier, like, their big stars are their guards. Like, Chizoa and Hayes, I guess Hayes is a forward, but like Bullard, like they have like a lot of big name.
It's like a stretch forward.
Yeah, they have like a lot of big name guys, and like they've just been really inconsistent in offense. Like after, like pretty much dominating Duke before like blowing that whole like second half. Like maybe that just like damaged their psyche to a gigantic level. Like, it'd be kind of surprising if that was actually the case, but. I don't know what else you can say. Like, they just played so poorly this past week where, like, you, like, have to look ahead and, like, be kind of encouraged that you can get, like, what should end up being a really good team, like, catch them while they're down and then have a really nice win on your resume.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Is like, are they going to catch them while they're down and Kyle Washington is going to absorb all those missed threes and get a double-double tomorrow night? Or is Florida going to bounce back and UT is going to play the kind of perimeter defense that we saw last Saturday? It's I don't know. It's I think UC can definitely win this game. They're obviously talented enough to contain Florida, and Florida kind of plays the kind of style that I would think UC would prefer, being able to use UC's length all over the court to disrupt the guards. At the same time, UC played horrible perimeter defense against Xavier, and I hope we don't see that all over again. So I don't know what to think going into this game.
Next, like, you don't want to, like, just take your chances and then, like, have Florida just, like, bomb away from three and just bounce back.
Right, that's the thing. Is like, they could get hot early, and then all of a sudden, that's just who they are again, as a good three-point shooting team once they've found that hot hand again. So, I don't know. I mean, I would be concerned if we start seeing the score float. Like, God, Florida has had 400-point games this season. And I would be concerned if this score starts to float into, like, the 70 or 80-point mark. 70 not so much, but, like, you know, high 70s, early 80s is where I'm going to be really concerned. Like, if at halftime we're at, like, 30 or 40 points either way, I would be kind of concerned.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you on that one. Like, it's like Florida has been one of the, like, a mediocre two-point shooting team. Cincinnati's two-point defense is always really great. It seems like it's really going to come down to free throw, like the free throw line. Like, where Florida's...
Oh, God.
Florida's been, like, kind of, like, crushed on the free throw line. Like, their opponents are hitting, like, 80%, which is kind of insane.
Oh, that's good news, okay.
Bearcats, only shooting, just shooting under 68% as a team. Just, like, not great. Bearcats' free throw defense, also terrible. Like, the opponent's shooting 72%. So, I guess this is good news for both teams, if they can make free throws against each other. But it's really, I think it's just going to come down to the perimeter game. If, like, they can turn off Florida's, like, three-point shots, like Florida State and like Loyola did, like, you have a great chance to win. Like, you just have to just follow through and, like, play it or bounce back defensively. And so I think the Bearcats have a good shot.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think if I was going to pick it, I would say UC, like, UC 74, Florida 68 or 70. Just I need to have something good happen this weekend. Last weekend, the problem is that they played the shootout and then just sat on it for a week. So we've been, like, thinking about the shootout for a week. So I need something good to happen tomorrow night. I'm saying UC 74. I'll say Florida, like, 68 or 70. Yeah. Really hoping it's not going to be a shootout.
I'll go a little lower. I will say UC wins, but I'd say 67 to 64.
Okay.
I was feeling like, kind of confident about this game, like, even like after the Duke game, but like now especially, I don't know why. Like since we've been talking about how bad Florida's been, it's kind of making me think Florida's gonna win. I don't know why. Like, I'm just being pessimistic now.
Well, because I mean they. Like, Florida's strength is a three-point shooting. I mean, they've been bad the last couple of weeks, but their strength is still the guards and the three-point shooting. And UC allowed Xavier to make, what, 10 of 21 and start off the game shooting 64% from the field or from three. So, yeah, I mean, your concern is justified. I mean, I'm like cautiously optimistic UC wins this game. Like, I think if we talked about this game 2 weeks ago when Florida was, you know, everyone thought they were a Final Four team, I think I would have called UC losing. But I would have been confident in that. I was thought, oh yeah, this is just going to be a loss. It's going to be a good loss on the schedule. We'll absorb the loss and move on. Now I'm like cautiously optimistic, but I'm also like just more concerned that they would just lose again. I don't know if that makes sense.
Like, just with the way that, like, the non-conference was laid out with these like four marquee games like all in a row.
Mm-hmm.
Like going 2-2 or 1-3 or 0-4 is just really gonna hurt. Like I know like the league looks like kind of solid, but like you definitely need some of these big nine conference wins. And this would be a good one to get, and like roll on to Mississippi State early next week.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like this key stretch here, it's like. So the marquee non-conference was obviously this stretch, Xavier, Florida, Mississippi State, UCLA. Going into the year, we knew Xavier and Florida were gonna be tough games, but they were going to be good opportunities for resume-building games. Mississippi State, UCLA, a little bit. I mean, I think Mississippi State is going to be a lot – they're going to end up a lot better at the end of the year than they're looking at right now, and then UCLA the opposite because – I don't know what the hell is happening over there with with that team. I don't know. If they go 1-3, like I feel like going into this stretch, I thought 2-2 was going to be the minimum, and I would have been happy with that. But I'm getting concerned that this team is going to go 1-3, and then it's just going to be – it's going to be basically – we're going to be reliant on the conference schedule again to bolster the resume.
That would be kind of depressing.
It would be depressing, but I mean, like, Mississippi State's a good team. UCLA has kind of dropped off a little bit, but Mississippi State is good. I mean, UC gets them at home and everything, and I think Mississippi State, they look better against Dayton. They kind of let Dayton back. I mean, that's still a good team. Luckily, they really haven't been challenged until they actually visit UC in a couple of weeks. Or, I'm sorry, on what, Tuesday? So, I mean, who knows? I don't know. I would be very disappointed if UC winds up going, yeah, like 1-3, and their only win ends up being Mississippi State or UCLA. Like, I think this team is capable of beating both Mississippi State and UCLA, and then a coin flip against Florida.
Yeah, cause,
like, as it stands right now.
Yeah, because it seems like... Like, they should be Mississippi State. They should be favored in that game. Like, assuming nobody gets hurt against Florida.
Right.
I like the Florida game, and UCLA kind of like coin flips. Like, it's really... Like, UCLA is kind of in a weird spot right now. I guess they play Michigan tomorrow. So it'll be interesting to see how they look. Like, if they, like, roll Michigan, that's definitely a game to be worried about. Like, especially since it's on the road.
Yep.
But 2-2 would be like wouldn't be that bad, but like 1-3 with like your only win at home and like losing two road games and like your big neutral site game would take a lot of air out of the early part of the season until you really like dove into league play and got like that Temple SMU stretch. It's like there's really nothing impressive after that with like Pine Bluff and Central or Cleveland State and Memphis, who's not very good. But
yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. It's like taking the air out of the season a little bit. Like, I think, you know, UCLA, they're still a good team. That's going to be a marquee win if UC beats them. But, I mean, I don't know. Just that little shine of beating a top five Florida team, just, I don't know, it just feels good. It just makes it feel good.
It definitely would. It's also a big game for the point guards. Like a huge matchup, like in that sense, like with Florida's good backcourt.
Right.
Like, they also did not have good defensive games. Like, Broom had a really good offensive game against Xavier. Like, Jennifer had, like, 4 assists. But, like, you want to see them really bring it against a team this good. Like you said, they're still in the top five.
Right.
So, like, getting, like, a top five win, like, always looks good. And we know, like, there's a big emphasis on these road neutral site games this year with, like, the new selection sheets. So it can be a pretty great win to have. And we both think they're going to win. So that's good.
That is good. It is good. I'm cautiously optimistic. But it is still good. Do you have any other thoughts, Scott? I have a couple more minutes.
I can't think of nothing pops to mind. What about, I am glad Wichita State is in the league. Like,
Oh, God, yes.
Throw that in real quick. Like, we talked about it last time we did the podcast, but it's like since then they like beat Baylor, and like they just like look pretty good. And it's like good to have like another team in the league that has like big, like early season games that like, are on TV and like get people talking about what they're doing, like because SMU like their game against TCU like not even on TV, just kind of like a weird thing. I wonder why that happens. But yeah, it's like you see Wichita State like SMU even like Temple is off to a solid start. Like Wisconsin's not good, but they beat Wisconsin. Like, Houston looks, like, pretty decent. Like, they beat the hell out of Arkansas. It's like, so maybe you, like, have some depth. And, like, Wichita State just adds that, like, another marquee team for, like, all these other ones to, like, square up to and, like, maybe, like, have some intrigue. And not just wait for UC to play them to be interesting.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, before Wichita State, UC was, or not UC, the AAC was pretty much guaranteed two bids in the tournament. Adding Wichita State, you pretty much lock yourself in for three, and then everything after that is gravy. You got to figure right now, Wichita State, SMU, and UC are basically those three. And then, hell, if Temple ends up having a good year, maybe they get a fourth bid. If UConn or Houston end up having a good year, maybe they get the fourth or the fifth bid, depending on what happened there. I mean, adding Wichita State, like to your point, it basically gives every other team in this league an opportunity at a marquee win. And, you know, besides like SMU or Cincinnati. And it makes the entire league better. I would just be curious what happens in that middle there. You know, the problem with this conference is that the bottom really dragged the conference down. I mean, ECU is and South Florida are going to be those teams this year. But the middle was always kind of like mediocre at best. And it's hopefully risen a little bit better to kind of like that top 100, top 150 level. And you got to hope that, you know, Wichita State, you know, helps improve that as well. So yeah, definitely Wichita State, welcome to the American, and we are happy to have you.
Do you have anything else to add before we sign off for this week?
No, I'm good. Go Bearcats. Hopefully you beat Florida and we can all have a happy Saturday.